yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me doing everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah, watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nader Barkos, a former CIA analyst on the team charged with analyzing the relationship between Saddam Hussein, al-Qaeda, and 9/11. During the Iraq War, she became the chief targeting officer following the al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, Zarqawi. As an analyst at the CIA, Nader wrote and contributed to key intelligence reports from the front lines in Iraq, reports delivered to the White House, congressional leaders, and the Department of Defense. Her latest article in Wired magazine is, "I Tried to Make the Intelligence Behind the Iraq War Less Bogus." Welcome to Background Briefing, Nader Barkos.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And did you, by any chance, catch the Showtime documentary on Dick Cheney recently?
You know, I actually missed that. I was at Sundance for another premiere for an HBO film that I am in, and I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very interested in watching that one.
Well, it's extraordinary in the serene kind of bubble of denial, in a way, that the vice president's in, because the weight of the evidence from other people in the film was overwhelming. Particularly, what was interesting was the estrangement between Vice President Cheney and former President Bush, where towards the end they weren't speaking to each other, and they haven't since, apparently. And that was an interesting part of it. But the key part was 9/11 in many ways, which a lot of people have seized on. Who gave the order? It was the president informed about the order to shoot down the plane in Pennsylvania, etc. But I spoke recently with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's chief of staff, and he's more or less said that we've all missed the point, that what drives Cheney and what drove the Iraq War was what happened on 9/11, in as much as the Bush administration and its leaders were absolutely terrified, he said, quoting him, that they'd be impeached because their number one job is to protect the United States, and they had ignored all the intelligence, and that was what was mostly on their mind. Do you share that thought?
You know, I don't know exactly if they would be worried about being impeached, but I do think that some of the preemptive doctrine that, you know, Wolfowitz subscribed to and some of the advisors subscribed to had a role to play in this invasion. I mean, I actually think there was just very little understanding of the Middle East and how to affect any change there. So I think they saw this as this country strategically placed between Iran, you know, and some other countries we'd like to affect. This is obviously a target. They don't, you know, nobody thought Saddam was a good leader, a benevolent leader. So I actually think that this was, in their minds, the right place to go.
But the sense that the country needed some vengeance, if you will, and I recall that Donald Rumsfeld said about Afghanistan that there are not enough targets, in a way, that it wasn't a sufficient war. So is that a possibility, that they were so freaked out about blowing it over 9/11 that they really, in a way, tapped into the kind of national zeitgeist of wanting to prove something, that we were a wounded country and we had to strike back?
I mean, I do think, you know, when you look at sort of the atmosphere around post 9/11, you know, the entire country was on edge. We were sort of wondering, well, what's next? You know, is this going to happen again? Is there a follow-on attack? You know, even 2002 and 2003, you know, we were still having all these color-coded things coming out of Homeland Security on alerts. So I do think, you know, you can't look at this outside of how that affected everybody's decision-making at the time. But do I think it was their concern that they weren't getting after al-Qaeda and that this would therefore help? No, I don't think it had anything to do with that. And I, you know, from my point of view, I can't imagine that they thought it would help.
So in terms of what you were tasked to do and the group that you worked for, we first learned about the influence of Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby during the Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson affair, if you will. It sort of came out that Vice President Cheney and his aide, Scooter Libby, had spent a lot of time at the CIA, and that was unusual in itself. So let's begin there. That was unusual to have the Vice President and his top aide essentially micromanage the CIA?
Yeah, it was absolutely unusual. I mean, if you can imagine being the head of a company and getting bogged down in the weeds of a manager's job, basically, you know, what they're covering and how they're doing it and exactly what they're finding and trying to know more about the subject than they do. I mean, that's micromanaging at its best, and it is unusual and unprecedented for a policymaker to come to the agency and spend that kind of time going over that kind of, you know, intelligence in that way.
And from your article in Wired magazine, Nada Barkas, your group essentially had to do rehearsals. You had what's called a murder board, where you had characters, almost like presidential debates, playing Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby so that you could prepare yourself for the dissection that would come from these two. I take it what totally blew you away was you watching television when Dick Cheney suddenly said that there's no doubt that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein are working together. I said this on Meet the Press, that they have a longstanding relationship with various terror groups, so including the al-Qaeda organization. So describe that moment, if you will.
So Sundays, that was kind of my only downtime, because we were working quite a bit around the clock, and that was just my way of sort of catching up on, what the press was saying and sort of the mood of the country. And, you know, watching Tim Russert, he always seemed to get at the right questions. It was kind of cathartic to have him asking these administration officials these questions on a show. And, you know, when Cheney would say comments like that, it's just, you can pick it apart and you can say, well, you need to caveat that with, but he never does. And so while he can say a longstanding relationship with the al-Qaeda organization, that doesn't actually represent what the intelligence said. We didn't find any real connection between the two of them. While there might have been some low-level al-Qaeda leaders talking to somebody inside of Iraq, there was no government collusion with the organization. So, you know, it's funny. It's almost like a trial. You know, just it was spin. That is accurate. It was spin.
And, of course, it was concerted and orchestrated with Condoleezza Rice talking about we don't want a mushroom cloud. We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Have you ever figured out what was driving them? It's always been puzzling to me that, for example, people like Brent Scowcroft, who warned in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about what a disaster it would be, that somehow Bush's father didn't intervene. I know from the Showtime documentary the extent to which Dick Cheney created the government. He staffed it and effectively did a kind of end run around George W. Bush for the entire first term, but eventually apparently the president figured it out. So what was their collective motive there? Was it Oedipal? Was it, I don't know, I'm floundering here because I mean, still to this day, this monumental piece of history has never been explained. They never explained why they're going to war. They never even had a meeting about going to war.
I mean, I actually think there's an article in Harper's Magazine that touches on the preemptive doctrine and how far back that philosophy goes for Paul Wolfowitz. And I do think that plays a large role in their mindset at the time. And I just think there was a lack of understanding by the administration on the Middle East, on the culture, on Islam as a religion. I just think that there wasn't a distinction between being able to go in and invade a country and then understand what the rebuilding effort needs to look like. And I think they were incredibly, in some ways, naive in their approach. I think they actually thought this was a good thing to do. This was a good idea.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Barkas, the former CIA analyst on the team charged with analyzing the relationship between Saddam Hussein, al-Qaeda, and 9/11. And during the Iraq War, she became the chief targeting officer following the al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, Zarqawi. And as an analyst at the CIA, Nada wrote and contributed to key intelligence reports from the front lines in Iraq, reports delivered to the White House, congressional leaders, and the Department of Defense. Her latest article in Wired magazine is, I Tried to Make the Intelligence Behind the Iraq War Less Bogus. Now, what does this say then about an organization like the CIA, which is, I understand, people, all throughout the ranks are encouraged to speak up. Your job is to get it right, and you only have one chance at getting it right. So one would think that collectively there would be a lot of power or pressure, if you will, But on the other hand, history tells us, and particularly Colin Powell spending a couple of days there outside of George Tenet's office going over the intelligence before he made his UN speech, is that a couple of determined people in a government can make an enormous difference. So is there a disparity there between the collective understanding of an institution about reality and people who are trying to make their own reality?
Yes, absolutely, because I think the danger, you know, the takeaway from this is they were basically operating in an echo chamber. When you look at the Undersecretary Doug Feist, he had basically started a parallel intelligence unit to evaluate our intelligence, as in my team that was looking at the Al-Qaeda-Iraq relationship, if there was one. He started a parallel effort looking at that, not at new intelligence, not evaluating the intelligence necessarily that we had already gone over in sort of an objective sense to test it, but rather to disparage the findings that we already had, because that was their outcome. That there was an actual briefing that they did, that you know, bullet points of why we were wrong, stating that there was no relationship and it was just cherry picking intelligence. And you know, I don't know exactly what was behind some of that, because we were able to just, you know, pull it apart and shred it and show how wrong they were. But I think that's where they run the danger, is operating on an assumption that's false and not having the right people and the right dissenting voices in the room is very dangerous.
Well, it's also disappointing that the loyal opposition rolled over for the war resolution, because I spoke with Senator Bob Graham, who was in charge of the Intelligence Committee, and he told me that the White House didn't even want an NIE and that he forced them to provide an NIE. And then Doug Feist, as you mentioned, did his own version. But yet so many people like John Kerry, Hillary Clinton and others have voted for that war resolution. And those on the Intelligence Committee who knew that the case wasn't made, most of them voted against it, at least the Democrats did, with the exception of John Edwards and Dianne Feinstein. So does that bother you as an American, that we don't have a...
It does.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, when you look at that NIE, and I'll say I was not on the WMD side, so it's not, you know, I'm not wedded into the detail of exactly how that all played out, but the NIE, even as flawed as that NIE was, it said that he was still 2 years out from even creating a deployable weapon, WMD weapon of some kind. So it's not an imminent threat. You know, and if Congress would have paid attention and read the versions that they had, which not very many of them did, you know, there would have been a lot more questions and probably a lot more people voting no. And I think also would have helped media also evaluate how the case for war was being made.
Well, unfortunately, it feels like we haven't learned a thing, because there's a sort of parallel going on now with Iran, because the head of the Director of National Intelligence just testified to the Senate last Tuesday and made a clear case that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, but they could have it very quickly if a political decision to have one is made. And that flies in the face of what the Congress is saying, what the press is saying. I mean, it feels like we've seen that bad movie before.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have, obviously, access. I left the organization in 2008 to know really where that stands. But I think the case for war should never be so difficult. It should just be obvious. And it should be an international community that weighs in, and we should be listening to those voices as well. Because they did share a lot of that assessment. A lot of our allies shared some of that same process and thought process on Saddam's capabilities for WMD. And yet they were still saying, no, this is not a good idea. So,
some of the key stuff there was, for example, the Yellowcake Niger, that was based on forged documents. You yourself had to prove that documents that were found in Iraq after the invasion linking the Iraqi intelligence service to the terrorist Abu Nidal were also forged, and they were eventually presented to Dick Cheney.
Actually, those documents stated that there was a connection between Saddam's regime and Muhammad Atta, which was one of the 9/11 hijackers.
Yeah.
And Abu Nidal, you know, was in and out of Iraq, and everybody already knew that. That wasn't the hot ticket issue at the time. And we were able to easily disprove that these, you know, documents were false by a variety of methods, including the fact that Mohammed Atta, we knew, was in the United States by all of his, you know, credit card transactions and everything else the FBI had already done.
So, but it's pretty extraordinary to me that nobody's ever followed up on who actually forged both the Yellow Cake documents, which became, of course, a huge part of the argument for war, and to a lesser extent, the documents that you and your team disproved.
And I think it'd be very difficult to figure out, because they were found by, you know, they were found inside of Iraq. We evaluated the documents in a forensic manner as much as we could. And it's nearly impossible to tell who actually did it unless you have a source willing to come forward and say that. And, you know, I don't know how many resources were applied in doing that at the time, but, you know, our job was to make sure that we didn't miss anything and that if we could, you know, prove or disprove the validity of those documents, that's what we needed to do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Neda Bakos.
Yeah, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Neda Bakos, who's a former CIA analyst on the team charged with analyzing the relationship between Saddam Hussein, Al-Qaeda, and 9/11. During the Iraq War, she became the chief targeting officer following the Al-Qaeda leader in Iraq, Zarqawi. As an analyst at the CIA, Neda wrote and contributed to key intelligence reports from the front lines in Iraq, reports delivered to the White House, congressional leaders, and the Department of Defense. Her latest article in Wired magazine is "I Tried to Make the Intelligence Behind the Iraq War Less Bogus." We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about a letter sent to the president today about contradictions in what he's going to do about Social Security and Medicare.